At the famous press conference in which it was announced that Grand Funk intended to play before and fill Shea Stadium in the summer of 1971, Mark Farner also took the time to announce an intention of his own. After stating his belief in the need for nonviolent change and revolution, and conceding that change not coming from nowhere has to start small if it's going to start at all, Farner announced that he was using his own money from the corporation to buy trash cans for his hometown of Flint, Michigan, in order to make a first step towards doing something positive for health conditions, and consequently for ecology. It was a tense, in many ways hostile press conference, in which only five or six reporters showed up, astounding and angering Terry Knight, who felt that the biggest and most popular rock group in history was again being slighted by the media. According to Terry, the group has a long history of getting bad reviews, shabby coverage, and even being downrightly ignored by the press. Even at first glance, it seems true. Where are the Life magazine articles about this phenomenon? Where is the momentous appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show? Why are the talented boys' names not the household words that Ringo, John, and Paul were to become? There were dark rumors spreading that Terry Knight had, in fact, not invited all the reporters to the press conference that he might have, all for sinister reasons of his own. What actually happened, according to one reporter, was that the way the press release was written intimidated many members of the press into not wanting to come. It read, and we can judge for ourselves if this is true, or if again the press was turned off to the railroad's trip, "After 2 years, Grand Funk has finally consented to meet with the press." The railroad telling this himself felt intimidated by the release, yet was one of the media's representatives present for it. In any case, it is sometimes too much to hope to understand either what causes the magic in a supergroup's super appeal or every action and statement of a morose and manic genius like Terry Knight. Perhaps he was trying to dramatize the lack of concern on the part of the press for the band. This is an issue of deep concern tonight, particularly because since he already feels that the boys are spokesmen for their generation, that they very possibly might be persecuted by the establishment for exactly that reason. What we were talking about was the bad vibes at the press conference, which intimidated Farner into what Terry Knight thought was a tragic silence. Here's how Terry Knight described it. What the press failed to realize yesterday, and the tragedy, is this. Mark Farner made some terribly pertinent comments. He talked about revolution. We knew they were going to ask him about revolution, which is why we wanted the press conference, so we could confront the press so they could print it, because we feel we are spokesmen for the generation. We call a press conference because we feel we represent the brothers and sisters. We call the conference so we could speak for them. We provided them with every statistic in the history of the group. We gave them every reason to be there. I can't say to the press, don't you people realize the power you have? When Mark Farner says he wants to give trash cans to the city of Flint, you ask him, what are you going to do with your money? We get another clue to the mystery surrounding the press conference and Terry's behavior with respect to it from the following quote. For years we baited the press, and I'll be the first to admit it. How do I get a press on a group that doesn't drop their pants? How do we make the headlines? It's inherent in the game, right? If we go into this to win, then we have to make headlines. I fed the press information that was true. You can't lie about attendance records. Christ, they've broken every attendance record in every city they played in the United States. You can't say to the press that Grand Funk broke attendance records and have it turn out to be a lie. It has to be the truth. We don't try to hide how much money they make. Somebody would find out. We've always been honest about it. The fact is that we fed the press information that should have been picked up as news. And so, Terry Knight's impetuous struggle with the press goes on. He claiming that the press ignores his group's message to talk about the money they make or the trouble they cause. Which is bad, since because they are not the kind of boys who cause much trouble, they thereby fail to get as much exposure as less mature groups. Something which makes it hard for them to overcome. And when Mark actually wants exposure and help from the media to start something good, like the trash can venture. The press, on the other hand, feels that Knight is trying to exploit his histrionic relations with it for publicity purposes, and, as we heard earlier, that he may insult or talk down to them condescendingly. Knight's rejoinder is, "Man, they don't want to know what our brothers and sisters have to say, even though we represent them." He feels that if the press would prove more on what it was Grand Funk's audiences experienced as the message, and less on just their music or money or troublesome incidents, those bad-vibing meetings with the press might not happen. We don't need the press, man, ever, ever. Man never says night. I never asked the press to print a review of Grand Funk. I never asked for a press to go to a show. As a matter of fact, I refused to give one free ticket. On this whole tour, states Terry, referring to the summer of 71 tour, the press was uninvited and unwarned, because that was a gathering for Mark and Don and Mel and their people. It was a happy time. We don't want any downs, any bummers, man. We can take care of our own. We don't want the press, the establishment there to lie about it, man, or change it. Although he won't like to admit it himself, Terry Knight is very much aware of his group's media image and thinks about it a lot, how it stands up in comparison with the media images of other groups. For example, he is aware of how pleased everyone was with the initial impression of the Beatles when they came over to the United States. You know, they were breezy, funny, articulate. Their press conferences were entertaining, big news, and everyone came. Terry wants desperately to feel that his press conferences, the one in which Grand Funk finally consented to meet the press after 2 years and told the world it intended to fill Shea Stadium like the Beatles had, would be as big a turning point in getting the railroad loved and as permanent a household word as the Beatles' early exposure had made them loved and well known. Knight would like to be assured of at least some additional tokens of security for his group's unprecedented popularity. It's understandable. No group has ever risen so fast, so high, and yet with a press that has been as generous in its coverage of them as it would be with news of a heat wave in the Sahara Desert. How much longer can it all last? Already there are critics, and there are always critics, who say that Grand Funk is a flash in the pan, that the railroad will disappear down the track, man, that what goes up most likely will come down, and so on. With this in mind, let's listen to some more of Terry's words with regard to how he feels, or perhaps would like to feel, about that press conference. For 2 years, we fought hard to go to that press conference, which one day I hope will be written up as the press conference if somebody ever writes a book on us, man. Because it was a turning point for Grand Funk. Because it gave us more direction, more unity, more oneness, singleness of purpose than anything in the last 2 years. We were laughing hysterically about it in the car afterwards. We can assume that the hysterical laughing, though, was an expression of how the group, suddenly very uptight, if Terry Knight is right, responded to what it all at once realized it was up against in the establishment. Sometimes laughter is the only way one can say anything. But what other reasons are there, besides the possible insecurity of Funk's popularity, which might explain Knight's need to build everything up the way he does? After all, the group is working well, financially set, admired and loved by at least the greater part of its audiences. Part of the answer can be found in what was said earlier about Terry's short taste of fame and how he desired more of it. But there is also Terry Knight's personal motto of, "You can't follow to win," which should be mentioned. You cannot stand in the background and then expect victory to come up to you. Which brings us finally to reveal what Terry Knight actually said to Mark, Don, and Mel during that phone call just after the boys returned from being stranded in New England. He told them in no uncertain terms that there would be no question who the leader would be. "The only thing I demand," said Terry in his typical understated fashion, "is that you do what I say. I'll discuss any decision with you for as long as you want, but afterwards. There are going to have to be a lot of quick decisions, and we won't have time to discuss them ahead of time." Terry justifies his opinion now by pointing out it all has to follow a pattern. It has to fall into place. "There haven't been any mistakes with Grand Funk. I made a lot of mistakes early in my life, and I learned from them." So we can begin now to see how deeply the Knight ego is involved with the reception given to Funk anywhere, anytime, and in any way. Even when his motives and behavior are unclear, whether one likes him or not, and there are most emphatically many enemies in Terry Knight's kingdom, one thing you can't help but say about the man is that he is brutally frank and outspoken about his feelings, particularly when they are pissed off feelings. This pissed off side of Terry Knight gets exposed pretty frequently. He reminds one a lot of another non-musical kingpin in the rock world, Bill Graham. Both are serious to the point of absolute humorlessness, are involved in a good number of big bread dealings, possess egos whose capacities for expansion might only be compared to gases found in the hemisphere of other planets, are prone to talk of themselves in the third person, and in general are a pair of very significant movers in the action economics of the counterculture. But to return to Mark Farner and the frustration of trying to be non-violently revolutionary without help from the media, when the press actually asked Mark how he would like to make the world a better place, Farner responded to the questioning reporter, "I would sit down with you and tell you, but it would take a long time because there are a lot of things I want to do, and I have a lot of money to do them with. But one of the things is buy trash cans." Farner quite clearly made a very intelligent decision in offering to talk about his private hopes and plans in a smaller conversation, both for the reasons he gave and because he realized it might be dangerously bad form to reveal too much about himself in front of an already admittedly hostile group of establishment reporters. It was a smart move indeed by the young man, one adequately demonstrating that he's as good handling himself offstage as on. But to find out some of those things Mark is into, we have no recourse at the present time but to rely on Terry Knight. Here's what he has to say about the young man's plans. "Well, I can tell you what they want to do more in depth now, what the press didn't want to hear then, and what Mark has been too uptight because of the tenseness of the situation to follow through on. Right, there's a factory with several thousand rotting, rusty, filthy yellow drums. Mark wants to buy every oil drum this country has got right now. He wants to buy them with his own money and paint them red, white, and blue, man, like it's the color of our country. So far, all we've done mostly is talk about Grand Funk's personal message and personalities, about the group's music apart from everything else. What about that? Where in the history of pop music did the band fit in? We can begin by saying it all goes back to Cream, the Baker, Clapton, Bruce trio that made such beautiful controlled use of volume and fuzz, playing on just drums, guitar, and bass. This supergroup cut the original heavy pattern that was to be cut out and experimented with by other three-piece bands, such as the James Gang and Mountain. Felix Pappalardi, in fact, used to produce Cream before he became the regular bassist for Mountain and a molder of its sound. An interesting thing about the James Gang, and something worth chewing over, is why, when they came up at about exactly the same time as Railroad, were just as loud and emanated a similar type of appeal, did the group never make it anywhere as near as big as Funk. At any rate, what Funk did was to combine the big sound Cream founded with its own Detroit brand of shake-ass Motown soul. One of the Grand Funk's biggest influences and models, as Mel Shasher likes to point out, is Jimi Hendrix. During a conversation with Mel and his girlfriend mentioned before, Shasher stated he would like to be able to emulate Hendrix, to which his girlfriend Dina interjected, "His music, but not his way of life." Dina, by the way, knows that she really hasn't got too much to worry about, because, as Gentle Mel himself admits, "I don't even get to see many groupies anymore. When I do, nothing happens." Anyway, the feeling between Grand Funk and Hendrix is to a large extent reciprocal. According to Terry Knight, who does not feel that his bag needs to be bragging about how many superstars come backstage and want to cut albums with us, himself has admitted that Hendrix, and as a matter of fact at other times, John Lennon too, have been backstage to talk to Funk more times than I could count. Once, after the first time Jimi Hendrix had seen the Railroad perform, Jimmy went backstage, sought out Mark, and told him, "Kid, you're out of sight." To anyone who has seen and had the privilege of watching and hearing the late Jimmy perform, the parallel with Mark will be obvious. Both are, or in the tragic case of Jimmy were, solo string musicians with spellbinding qualities of showmanship. Although all of the band's albums are, of course, gold, most Funks will agree that the group's Grand Funk Live album really tells Funk's message like it is best. Somehow it just works. All that live electric energy from Atlanta, Georgia, captured and coming at you from your own phonograph and speaker. As if that alone weren't enough, the record contains performances of most of the band's best-liked cuts. Numbers like Are You Ready?, the blockbuster with which the boys kick off all their concerts. I Need, which includes a rousing guitar solo by Farner. Paranoid, TNUC, with that fantastic Don Brewer drum solo with which Don also drove the huge Shea Stadium crowd wild with ecstasy. And Inside Looking Out, possibly the most popular of all Railroad cuts. A 12-minute version of the same number recorded on the Grand Funk Grand Funk album about a drug pusher who gives it all up to start rapping to the brothers and sisters. What this has to do with the revolutionary philosophy of the group, which we discussed earlier, is obvious. Some other of the band's best-known hits from other releases are Foot Stomping Music, a single released for radio in two different time links, one for AM and another for FM, from Railroad's E Pluribus Funk album, I'm Your Captain from the Closer to Home album, People That Stop the War, Heartbreaker, and that unbelievable version of Gimme Shelter from the Gimme Shelter Grand Funk album, which makes the Rolling Stones' own original sound, by comparison, as limp as a Tiny Tim jam with a Muddy Rivers Blues Band, according to some fans. Yeah, we know how that funk brand of rock, how that railroad style of playing shakes, but who does it shake the most? There are a few things that can be said about that. Grand Funk is the first band to really grab the younger teenagers who listen to music as well as the older fans. The young want to be liberated too, spiritually and physically. Funk, in realizing this, is the first band to address this audience, to bring a sophisticated, heavy sound to the really young's ears. And to the young's credit, they're showing themselves ready for it. That bubblegum sound had to go sometime. Everyone who likes to feel likes Grand Funk. Anyone who likes to get juiced up and get the most out of sounds, lights, people, booze, grass, even energy and life vibes of all sorts like what funk does. As the Railroad shows us in its act, everyone is entitled to feel free. Everyone has the right to feel free and can. One unfortunate consequence of this is that this very comprehension of the Railroad's message can, under some circumstances, be responsible for some of the trouble the boys have had at their concerts. The Anaheim Convention concert in Los Angeles in November 71 was a total sellout. Over 9,000 tickets were sold in advance. When it started, there were almost as many people waiting outside trying to get in. There was some crashing. A number of the disappointed fans who could not get in were a little stoned. The security cops were scared and called the real cops in. They had a little riot. Grand Funk had to promise to play two concerts in Munich, Germany in December of 71 during their Whirlwind European tour, one to make up for the one they weren't permitted to give the previous year when there had been a ticket sale riot. There have been similar problems in Detroit as well as in Japan. So while other groups might say, "I wish we had trouble like that," Grand Funk has nothing but regrets. It's a shame that although the incidents reflect in no way on any members of the group, the band had received a good deal of unjustified bad press because of them. This people power Grand Funk seems to evoke everywhere it goes is what has prompted Terry Knight to claim flatly, "The establishment is afraid of Grand Funk." We may get a chance to observe more closely the power of this threesome in the future and judge whether it can produce this fear in others. The well-known Maisley's brothers, authors of such stunning documentary spectacles as Salesman and Gimme Shelter, the brilliant film of the Rolling Stones' Altamont concert with a fatal stabbing recording, have been traveling with the Railroad and taking footage for the benefit of posterity. If the film comes off, it will be a good thing because we may not get to see much else of the Grand Funk for some time. According to the latest press releases from Brian Millman, the group's agent, Funk is taking a year hiatus from live performances starting this past December of 1971, the date marking the conclusion of their big European tour. It's for personal reasons, none of which, according to Terry Knight, have to do with internal strife of any kind. Some of the things the boys would like to do is help edit the Funk at Shea TV special, as well as the Maisley's Funk on Tour film. It may well be that the band simply wants a rest in order to get its head back together after the expending of too much energy. Grand Funk Railroad Enterprises has also announced that it is in the process of manufacturing cloth pocket patches, necklaces, bottle openers, belt buckles, cufflinks, book covers, stationery, all embossed with E Pluribus Funk design found on the album cover. Maybe the boys will be involved in some of these business-related enterprises during this time. This sixth E Pluribus Funk album, incidentally, costs $50,000 to put together. The actual platter is made of 100% pure virgin vinyl, which means that the vinyl is unprocessed and has never been used. This is a fancy innovation in record production, since most records are made from melted down old albums. Beneath what you are hearing, that means there could be an old cut buried from some song far in the past. In addition, this expensive album has been released on the artist's own label, an honorary one. Grand Funk is still under contract to Capitol Records. This was just a courtesy extended to the most popular group ever in honor of its 6 gold platter. Incidentally, when Terry Knight married a Swedish model recently, the bride, it is reported, asked for china embossed with E Pluribus Funk as her wedding present. So, now that Grand Funk is dropping from public view, what and how can we find out about them? Here's a possibility. We have here an exclusive conversation, for example, with a man who met the boys under the most informal of circumstances, the only ones we may get to meet the members of the band in, for some time. This is what the unpresuming, unsuspecting traveler had to say about encountering the railroad, from finding himself sitting next to them, just 3 freaky-looking guys on a long airplane trip from Atlanta to New York. Man, I didn't even know who they were, and they really seemed to dig it, too, not being known for a change. We played this long guessing game. I kept guessing things like cactus, mountain, and they would just laugh real hard and drop the candy they were eating on the floor. Really nice human guys, very down to earth, and not at all pretentious. I really liked them. I talked mainly to Mel and Don about music. Mark was a lot more withdrawn. You know, I've got family and friends in show business and know what these people can be like with all that traveling and hassle. These guys were really human and I liked them. Other personal things revealed about the boys come out. I figured they were from the South at first, coming from Atlanta, and that guy Don even had a slight drawl. It turns out that the South is where they first started to hit it big with those monster crowds. They said they really liked Atlanta. Mel and Don seemed to be really good friends and very much into each other's heads, at least on a lot of things. They even have a share in a commune down in Conyers, Georgia. Another quote from another occasion seems to confirm Mel's predilection for the South somewhat, where he says that he enjoys performing down there. Houston, man, that's my favorite. Everybody gets naked and stuff during the concerts. And so the group with the power to drive huge crowds to frenzy so total they begin to take off their clothes is dropping out for a while. Kids get their heads beat in every day, says Terry Knight, but the band that can still show you it's possible to break out of it, man, get away from white socks, skinhead haircuts, and working at the hardware store that tells you you can be anything you want to be, won't be telling us anything for a while, at least not live. Terry Knight says, these kids don't want to hear Mark Farner play his guitar, man. They want to see. That's why the top price tickets go first. The cheapy tickets go first at rock shows, but not with Grand Funk. They want to be close. They want to touch them. They want to see them. What funk fans will do without the opportunity to really see their idols up as close as Terry Knight describes it remains yet to be seen. Will they be waiting impatiently for the return? Will the power still be there when they come back? Sure it will. Bigger than ever.
We'll be right back.